You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Ann Lucas. If you are an American like me, you are drowning in a sea of insane things our government is doing, both at home and abroad as I record this. But only Trump himself is front and center when it comes to Palestine, and I can't think of a better person to hear from in this moment about Trump than Mustafa Barghouti. And fortunately for us, he appeared on the show Unapologetic, hosted by Ashfaq Karim. This is a regular feature on the YouTube channel for Middle East Eye that I always listen to, and you should too. The title of the episode was Palestinians Would Definitely Die Here and Not Leave, and it was a long-form interview with Dr. Barghouti. This episode of Unapologetic was shared on February 14th, 2025. You might remember that I started calling Dr. Barghouti the explainer-in-chief and defender of all things Palestinian in our U.S. media since October 7th. He must show up anywhere in English-language media these days to discuss Palestine, whether that means going into detail about specific developments, his perspectives, or just fighting with others about Palestinians' right to exist. Dr. Barghouti never met an argument he wasn't willing to have forcefully and able to carry off smartly. To be honest, I wish I could find a way to bottle up his intelligent perspectives, knowledge, and all-around chutzpah to distribute it to all of us working on Palestinian liberation. I guess what I'm trying to say is he's a unique force of nature we can all learn from, and I definitely not just learned things from listening to him in this interview, but literally just got inspired and got more energy to keep going for Palestine. And I think you will too. So this interview covers everything from Trump's ethnic cleansing real estate proposition to Jordan's King Abdullah II's visit to the White House and the latest on Israeli occupation violence in the West Bank. Dr. Barghouti also has some interesting thoughts on what's happening with Syria and the more philosophical question of connections between Palestinian liberation and Arab liberation more broadly. So I don't want to waste another minute talking so we can hear from Dr. Barghouti. And if you listen regularly, you know what that means, because we really do have a lot to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go.
Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you again. This is the second time you're appearing on our show, and obviously I don't think you need any introduction, but I'll introduce you anyway. You are the General Secretary of the PNI, the Palestine National Initiative, and I think over the last year, especially since October 7th, one of a very clear, loud, moral, defiant voice for Palestinians appearing regularly in the media. So welcome on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It's an interesting time that you, I mean, it's been an interesting time if I called you at any point in the last 16 months. But I mean, right, especially today, I think we're almost 24 hours since Trump met with, had a press conference with King Abdullah of Jordan. A few days before that, he met with Netanyahu. There's all sorts of outrageous things being said about Palestine, about Gaza. This follows outrageous things and completely inhumane things that happened to Palestinians and are still happening to Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Just what do you make of everything that's going on right now? I'm not going to go into the details of what those things are. Feel free to go into that, but we'll hone in on the question later on. But just as things stand, everything that's being said, what do you make of everything that's going on?
What I make is that we are in front of a very serious and dangerous conspiracy against the Palestinian people. A conspiracy that is led by the international Zionist movement, with Israel, of course, in the forefront. and a movement that has managed to get an alliance with the fanatic evangelical people in the United States. And it is clear they are in control of what's happening in the American administration, including the president. And what they are trying to achieve is nothing but complete elimination and liquidation of the Palestinian rights and the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people as people. We are talking about a movement that is trying to commit another genocide, another ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people, another Nakba, if I might say so, by speaking frankly and openly about terrible war crimes like ethnic cleansing of all the people of Gaza, and by talking about the annexation of the West Bank. So this is a settler colonial project that started in the beginning of or the end of the 19th century, achieved a big part of its goal in 1948 when it displaced 70% of the Palestinian people and took over 82% of the land of historic Palestine, and then completed the issue with the occupation of the remaining of Palestine. And now they want to conduct the second stage of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian people. This is what we deal with, in my opinion. This is the reality of the actual conspiracy we are subjected to.
Okay, so just going to, I mean, I'm sure you saw parts of, if not the whole press conference with King Abdullah and Trump yesterday. Donald Trump was using words like "we will have it," like as if though it's not even it's, the Americans will just take it. It's ours. We will build it there. We will look after it and cherish it. He said that at one point. And I mean, I think at least from maybe I'm interpreting this incorrectly, but King Abdullah did look uncomfortable. When he was asked by journalists, he said, "We are waiting for an Egyptian plan. There are some other Arab countries also making a plan." He has a meeting in Riyadh, clearly trying to buy time, but not trying to insult Trump at the same time. What is your interpretation of his reaction? And just, are you privy of any plan that's been drawn up in Arab capitals, as he suggests? And what do you think is going to come of that?
Well, before we speak about the Arab reaction, let's talk about, or let's specify exactly what Trump is saying. And somebody has to tell it in his face. I mean, because I think diplomatic words here are not sufficient. What President Trump is saying is that he is committed to three war crimes. The war crime of ethnic cleansing of all the Palestinians out of in Gaza, to kick them out of their homeland, to ethnically cleanse 70% of them the second time after they've been ethnically cleansed in 1948. And this is a war crime by international law. The second crime he is committed to is the annexation of the West Bank to Israel. He never said that clearly, as he did during the press conference with King Abdullah. When he was asked about Israel's annexation of the West Bank, he said, "Yes, it will happen." That is another war crime. The third war crime is the act of theft of another country, stealing it from its people, the people of Gaza, saying that he will take over the land. By which law? I mean, how could anybody say that? Like, what would have been his reaction if we said we want to come in and take over New York and send all the people of New York to Afghanistan? I mean, this is a terrible thing to be said. Yet it is said and clearly and openly by the president of the largest power in the world. And what does that mean? That means, and in my opinion, Gaza has exposed this fact to the world, that means we don't live by international law anymore. And that will have very serious implications to everybody in this world. But also it means that the United States of America and Israel are above the law and above international law. And it also means that Palestinians are not accepted as equal human beings to Jewish people, to Israelis, to Americans, or to any other people. This is horrible. But that's exactly what is happening. And during that press conference, of course, the king was not comfortable because he doesn't agree with Trump. He knows that displacement of Palestinians to Jordan would mean two things. First of all, it will create a huge political problem for the king because his people are totally against it. But more than that, it will change the demography of Jordan, that Jordan will stop being Jordan. And that's exactly what Netanyahu is after. And that was used to be the propaganda of Sharon, who used to say Jordan is the Palestinian state. And it fits very well with what Netanyahu wrote in his book, A Place Under the Sun, in 1995, when he said that when Balfour Declaration was issued, it promised Israel not only Palestine, but also Jordan. And Jordan didn't exist, as he said. And so if Palestinians go to Jordan, this would be their country. So in reality, we are talking here about something very dangerous for Jordan that is unacceptable to us too. And in my opinion, the king tried to use an intelligent way of avoiding the issue by talking about accepting 2,000 children that need cancer treatment, which is totally different from what Trump is talking about. And it seems that he was surprised there was media in the room suddenly, because this was not agreed about in the protocol. But nevertheless, I think the Arab countries have to get together now. They shouldn't leave Jordan or Egypt alone. They shouldn't leave Palestinians alone, as we were left during all this war. And that means, in my opinion, all Arab countries must get together and do three things. First of all, send a very clear message on behalf of all Arab and Muslim countries, the 56 countries, that his plan is totally unacceptable and rejected, and that these countries will stand against it. Trump doesn't understand that diplomatic language. He needs to hear it clearly and loudly. And as a person who is used to bullying people, he can retreat if he feels that there is a serious pushback. That's one. Second, I think these countries have to create a safety net for Palestinians to help them steadfast and stay on their land, and to provide support to the reconstruction of Gaza. So neither Netanyahu or Trump or anybody else will ever have the dream that he can displace Palestinians from there. But finally, I think this should establish a safety net for Jordan and Egypt. If Trump tries to play the game of blackmailing these two countries by cutting the financial support he's giving it to them, I think there should be an Arab safety net to help them. This is the way you can tell Trump to retreat, and you can send him a serious message about rejecting his plans.
Okay, I want to go back into what possibly is being discussed between Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and others. But before that, and I mean, I remember sitting with you almost a year ago now when we were discussing hypothetically when Netanyahu, and it was at the time also being occasionally flouted by Blinken, who eventually walked it back, that some of the Palestinians need to move from Gaza into Sinai. And you mentioned that Palestinians there would not it would be another Gaza, essentially. Maybe not what Gaza is now, but what Gaza was then. It would not have much rights, and there would still be refugees. But I mean, the idea is this was flouted initially a long time ago, as soon as this war almost began. And it's clear that when Blinken was making diplomatic calls to Arab capitals, he saw there's no appetite for this. Hence, it was walked back. It's also been clear that since Trump has been making these indications and saying it, suddenly Saudi Arabia has found a voice, a voice that kind of reminds us of the Saudis of the 90s and early 2000s, where it was very clearly behind the establishment of a Palestinian state. It has been rejected verbally, not yesterday by King Abdullah while sitting next to Trump, but by almost every other instance by Arab spokesmen in the last 2 weeks, which is again a positive sign. So just contextualizing all of that, what do you think, I mean, you've said what you hope is the Arab response will be, but what do you know of what the response is? Are you involved in any of the back channeling to them? And how can they sort of, I mean, it's one thing for them to do, is their only option being defiant, as you mentioned, and saying that they reject this completely? Will they be sort of strong-armed into something? Just how do you see this playing out?
Well, first of all, let me say that the original plan of the Israeli attack on Gaza was specifically the ethnic cleansing. The main goal was ethnic cleansing. And Netanyahu did not hide that. And he spoke about it in the very first days of this terrible war. And that's what his ministers spoke about, Gallant and others. And Biden reported that before he left his position as president of the United States in a late interview. He said that Netanyahu surprised him on the eighth day and told him that his plan is to evict everybody to Sinai. And when Biden told him this is unacceptable, and he said he will smash Gaza to earth, and when Biden told him that this might not be acceptable, Netanyahu responded by saying, why did you then, the United States of America, used nuclear bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And what did you do to Germany in the Second World War? And then Biden told him, but that was before we had United Nations and international law and so on. But anyhow, not that Biden did anything to stop him. On the contrary, Biden became a participant in the genocide. But today, the goal is to fulfill with political maneuvers and American pressure what Israel failed to achieve by military operation. Now, I do not think any Arab country can in any way support these plans of ethnic cleansing. But I also know that some of these countries will not do anything for us. That's well known. And if there was to be a serious reaction that would send a powerful message to Israel, it would have been the cancellation of all normalization agreements with Israel, including Abraham Accords. And that would send a very powerful message to Israel. I think the Saudis now are very clear that don't dream of normalization as long as you have these plans of ethnic cleansing. I think they've been consistent with their messages all the time, although foreign journalists and American journalists in particular tried to always read what was not written by the Saudis. The Saudis are saying very clearly that we have the Arab Peace Initiative. There will be no normalization without solving the Palestinian issue. So that's an important message, and it shows that Trump is not running a policy full of contradictions. From one side, he wants normalization, but from the other side, he wants to create ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. These two things cannot fit together. And so far, we've seen very strong, even much stronger reaction from Egypt. And obviously that Sisi canceled his visit to the United States mainly because of this issue, because he didn't want to be in the same situation as King Abdullah was. So the only way the Arab countries can push back effectively is to be together. And that's what the Jordanian king tried to allude to by saying there will be a joint Arab reaction. But it has to be blunt, and it has to be strong, and it has to be clear, and shouldn't use too much diplomatic words. Of course, it can be polite, but at the same time, decisive, that there is no way that anybody would accept ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people from Gaza. Look, by the way, what Trump wants is that the Arab countries not only accept ethnic cleansing, but also to pay for it. He wants Arab countries to pay for relocation of Palestinian people. Imagine, how far he has gone in his arrogance and his ignorance of the Palestinian people history first, and of the geopolitical facts of the region.
You know as well as anyone, and a lot better than me, that there's the Israeli habit, conniving habit of creating facts on the ground and a reality. So, for example, and you clearly, you very pointed it out in this interview, even when Biden thought the idea of ethnically cleansing Gaza was outrageous, he provided the bombs, and Netanyahu continued a policy of making Gaza unlivable to the point where now, I guess for someone who is sitting outside of this, recognizing that there's definite ethnic cleansing going on. At the same time, if Gaza is not rebuilt, and it's unlikely, unless a lot of pressure is put on Israel, that they will. And I do not see why Israel would want it to be rebuilt in any substantial way. I mean, just what are the options? And secondly, to me, the most dangerous thing about Trump's statements aren't its overt, craziness and its overt utterances of crimes, but the fact that it will now give Netanyahu, because when he didn't have that overt permission, he underwent a project whereby he could make Gaza unlivable. He's already begun for the last year and even before that, annexation of the West Bank has already been in place for a long time, even before October 7th. So how does that's going to continue, right? Netanyahu is going to accelerate his ethnic cleansing of the entire Palestine, both West Bank and the Gaza, most likely. So how does this actually impact the facts on the ground? And what form of resistance, diplomatic resistance, other resistance, how can Palestinians now resist this? What options do you have?
Before I joined your talk now, I was talking to our people in Gaza. And maybe you know we have about 80 medical teams working there and providing medical care to 200,000 people every month. And they're everywhere, in the north, in the center, in the south. You know what they were telling me? They were telling me this time, they were in the south, some of them were in the south because they were forced out from the north to the south, and then now they came back. They told me today that if anything happens again, if the war happens again, nobody will force us even to go to the south. We will die here and not leave. And that's the spirit that is dominating Gaza now, an unbelievable amount of resilience. Of course, life is difficult, but they are trying to rebuild with everything they have. I am so amazed about how many structures they have reactivated with very little resources. I don't think it's appropriate to me to start telling you how much I am proud of our people who I consider really heroes in Gaza. But the reality is that the people are, after what has happened to them, after this terrible injury, after losing 10% of the population of Gaza, who were either killed or injured, nobody didn't lose somebody. So they have horrible scars, but that made them even more determined than ever not to leave Gaza. So they could try what they want, but I do not think they will break the people of Gaza. No way. What we need as Palestinians, whether in the West Bank or Gaza, is three things, three words: resilience, resistance, and steadfastness. These are the three key words that will guarantee our future as people and guarantee us getting the freedom eventually. Of course, Netanyahu is trying to create facts on the ground. His dilemma, his biggest dilemma, are the facts of the ground that we have established, including a very vibrant Palestinian society, including the fact that we stayed in our land regardless of the dismissal of half of our people in 1948. The number of Palestinians on the land of historic Palestine now is 7.3 million versus 7.1 million Jewish Israelis. Maybe this is even less because some of them left during the war. And the only possibility is two solutions, either two-state solution, which Israel rejects, or one democratic state, which we would prefer, and Israel also rejects. So what remains? For them, the solution is ethnic cleansing. And of course, we will not allow that. So yes, our situation is difficult. We would have anticipated a bigger support from our brothers in the different Arab and Muslim countries, but that should happen. But whether it happens or doesn't happen, what Palestinians have learned in their history is the very big value of self-reliance. And at the end of the day, Netanyahu can try to do whatever he wants. The big question here is whether Palestinians will be broken or they will continue to resist his plans. I think resistance will be the case.
I mean, I hear everything you're saying. I can hear the defiance in your voice. We've all seen defiant images from the Palestinians. I mean, even before the genocide, their existence on the land, as you mentioned, was defiant. And it's very admirable. It's very courageous. But how long is it going to be sustainable? Trump and Netanyahu have already said that on Saturday, if more hostages are not being released, or if all of them are not being released, the ceasefire will go. I think both of us would probably acknowledge that the ceasefire was always a kind of a red herring that obviously provides a sense of relief for the people, but it was always a tactic for them to continue their plan of trying to ethnically cleanse or get as much of Palestinian land or deter the Palestinian struggle as much as possible. So outside of the defiance and the fact that people will try to build their lives out of rubble and hoping that there'll be a united stance verbally from Arab and Muslim countries, which even then may not actually materialize. It may materialize in slowing down any move of evacuating and building a place where Palestinians can go to, whatever that conditions may be like. But what realistic options are there? And I don't say this, I say this with a very heavy heart, and you probably hear this with even a more heavy heart. But how exactly can the Palestinians now, especially in Gaza, but also in the West Bank?
It's very simple. It's very simple. I'll answer you. If it reaches that point, we will die here and not leave. It's as simple as that. And let me remind you of many other situations before in people's history, where the key point was not to give up. When France was occupied by Germany, by the way, it took the Germans only 4 to 6 weeks, I think, to occupy all of France. It took the Israelis 15 months to break the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, and they couldn't up till now. And although the balance of power is very different, actually, I think the French army was much bigger than the Palestinian resistance. But when France was broken, the goal of the occupier is to break the will of the people. And there were people who lost their faith and were broken, like the head of the collaborative government of Vichy, who used to be the hero of France, you know, Pétain, Marshal Pétain. But there was another man called de Gaulle and the French resistance, which refused to give up. And eventually they won. And if people in Algeria who struggled against the French colonialism and who lost millions of people in their struggle would think in a rational way, they would not have succeeded. If people of South Africa have accepted apartheid as a regime they can live with, they would not have succeeded in liberating themselves. So we are here back to one of the clearest examples of a struggle of people against a colonial power, which is trying to crush them, with one difference, that not like in France or Algeria or South Africa, this colonial power not only wants to take over our land, it wants to displace us all out of our land. That is the main difference. And that should make us even more determined to fight back and to struggle.
Let's move a bit. I mean, it's part of the same conversation, but let's actually, just for the sake of our audience, just go a bit into the West Bank. There's two things I want to touch on. The first is just since the ceasefire is announced, there's obviously been an acceleration of Israeli attacks, bombardments on refugee camps and neighborhoods in the West Bank. Bear in mind, as you know, this has been happening already, but it's just accelerated quite a bit. Can you give us a sense of just how devastating the ethnic cleansing attempts and destruction in the West Bank is at the moment?
Yeah, there are three things happening in the West Bank, three processes. One is moving the war from Gaza to the West Bank because the level of bombardment and attacks Israel has started using even airstrikes against people, civilian population who are under their occupation in different parts of the West Bank. And they are using their all their mighty military power to invade areas to cause destruction. The second process is the ethnic cleansing of the people of the refugee camps in the north, especially Jenin, Tul Karim, Nur Shams, and Farah, partially, where the Israeli army have already displaced almost 50,000 people. And it continues its operation in Jenin camp for the 22nd day, destroying the infrastructure, destroying tens of houses and buildings in a ruthless manner, destroying electricity networks, water pipes, sewage systems, everything. And that is affecting even the cities of Jenin and Tul Karim. But these are not the only places where the Israeli army is acting. Actually, they have imposed on the West Bank no less than 920 military checkpoints. Each of these military checkpoints becomes a way of humiliating people, oppressing people, torturing people sometimes, and most importantly, preventing the freedom of movement in the West Bank, which is now cut into more than 300 pieces. And the gates they put in front of a village, for instance, when they put a gate and they close it, that's it. The village becomes a prison. Nobody can get in or out, even if you have a medical emergency or people who need to go to universities or whatever. It's a horrible situation, and it is affecting the whole of the West Bank. And that is done by the army. But in addition to the army, you have armed settlers, illegal settlers, who are constantly attacking Palestinian communities and also trying to evict people. 28 Palestinian communities have already been evicted by these illegal settlers with the help and support of and protection of the Israeli army. So it's a tough situation also in the West Bank, and it's growing. It's not stopping. And there is no more any area in the West Bank which is can be said to be under Palestinian authority. It's over. Israel took over everything. And they can invade any city they want, anytime they want. And this is another area where Palestinians are struggling to survive and to steadfast and to stay. But that is the reality. But I have to tell you that one of the worst things that happened since October 7th is the way Israel is treating the Palestinian prisoners. I've met with some of the prisoners that were released in the last exchange, and they told me horrible stories. I mean, beaten every day. Each time they come into their cells to count them, they beat them. One prisoner confirmed the case of sexual violation, and maybe you can call it, they use sticks to rape people. He told me about 25 cases he knew about. In another case, they forced people to be naked completely and then put the prisoners one on top of the other. Worse image than what happened in Abu Ghraib. And then the soldiers would be taking photos and sending the photos to their girlfriends and laughing at the people. But the beating, the humiliation, the starvation, nobody came out of jail that haven't lost one third or 40% of their weight or even maybe more. I was very angry when President Trump was talking about the three Israeli prisoners who had lost their weight because they were starved by Netanyahu. These people were in the north and they and their guards were starving. But nevertheless, these three cases became the topic of all Western media. And nobody said anything about the thousands of Palestinian prisoners who are kept in horrible condition. You know, people ask me what hurts you more of everything that had happened, the killing, the deaths, the injuries, the people I know about that were terribly terribly affected by losing everything they had. But you know what was the most hurting thing is the fact that we are not accepted as equal human beings by not only Trump, by Western media at large, by Western governments. This level of white supremacy and racism towards the Palestinian people is nothing but fascism. And actually what we are dealing with the Israelis now is nothing but fascism. That fascism that you see also in the behavior of many other governments. This is the most painful thing. And I think if people are objective, they will remember that Gaza really exposed these flaws of the world today.
You mentioned in your answer earlier on, you mentioned that almost the whole of the West Bank is in control now by Israel, not the Palestinian Authority. But just how much legitimacy has the Palestinian Authority lost? Can you tell me more about that? Just tell me the sentiment. Tell me why. Tell me what they've done. What they've been sort of collaborated with Israel with. Just more details than the average person would know.
I think the biggest problem the Palestinian Authority has is the fact that we did not have free democratic elections since 20 years, and that the authority canceled the Palestinian Legislative Council and dissolved it illegally in 2018. And that we don't have any separation between the judiciary, executive, and legislative systems. And that we are ruled by decrees, presidential decrees. The number of presidential decrees is much larger than the number of laws that were passed by any legislative council in Palestine. But on top of that, of course, it's the lack of unity. And for instance, now people are very angry because we managed to go to Moscow and then Beijing, all the 14 Palestinian forces. And we reached an agreement that I participated in drafting personally, Beijing Declaration, which is, in my opinion, a very realistic, applicable way of solving the internal Palestinian problems. And it talks about forming a national consensus government, but the Palestinian Authority is obstructing the implementation. It refuses the implementation. So this lack of movement towards unity is, of course, making people angry. But there are other things. The lack of understanding that the two illusions that they had before are gone, and they still keep hoping for them. The illusion of that the Zionist movement and Israel could accept a compromise with Palestinians. They don't understand that this is over and Israel doesn't want any compromise. And the second thing is that they still believe the United States can be a mediator, where you can see, I mean, what do you want more than Trump coming up and saying, I want to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians? So these are flaws, of course, that affect them. I mean, I don't want to attack them or criticize them or anything. The last thing I want is to be busy with the conflict with any Palestinian. But at the same time, the public is angry and it wants to see unity. It wants to see resilience. It wants to see a collective leadership, unified leadership of the Palestinians to face these most dramatic risks we ever had in our life. It's much worse than even 1948. So yes, of course, it affects the legitimacy and affects the popularity.
You've mentioned that the Palestinian Authority is unwilling to sort of play ball with the initiative a broader group of Palestinians came up with in Beijing. How much of that is because of their own innate stubbornness or problems, and how much of that is because of pressure from Israel? I mean, I'm sure there's a connection.
I don't have information about, facts about the pressure, but probably it is there. But I think it's all about wrong calculation of reading the situation and the future. And maybe part of it is about self-preservation and worry and fear from the dramatic changes that are happening around us.
Okay, I just want to now sort of speak a bit broader. And when I say speak a bit broader, it's that, I mean, we need to think and really try to use our imaginations and think out of the box and sort of to understand how liberation will come about. Because it, I mean, it's been a very long journey. And I think even in 67, when you know, the Naksa happened and Israel formally occupied Gaza and the West Bank, you were a young person back then. We spoke about this the last time, and you probably then would have thought that by 2025, the occupation would have ended, and it hasn't. So this could take a long time. It could take 40, 50, 60 years, maybe another century. It could be over next year, right? Obviously, the sooner, the better. But, I mean, you mentioned that if needs be, Palestinians will die on their land. Let's explore other options. To what extent do you think that Palestinian liberation is now connected to greater liberation of Arab peoples who have been living under oppressive regimes for a long time in almost all the neighboring countries of Palestine and even beyond?
Well, it was always connected. It's not new. And I said several times on different interviews that wise people should remember what happened after 1948. So many Arab regimes were changed. And the repercussion of what happened, the defeat that happened in 1948, was huge. And I do believe that you can, of course, some governments can suppress people, can rule people, can oppress people and prevent them from expressing their views, but they cannot rule their hearts and minds. And I know that the not vast majority, I think 99.9% of Arab people are with Palestine. And they will not accept what they are trying to do to us. So this will have repercussions, of course. But I do agree with you. I do agree with you. If it wasn't for this, The weaker the regime is in any country, and we've seen examples of that in so many Arab countries that were destroyed by the Americans and by, let's call it, imperialist forces in the world. When a regime is in bad relationship with its own people, it becomes absolutely vulnerable to external pressure. And that is the explanation of why some countries have very weak positions. You look at countries like Cuba, for instance. I'm not talking about ideology here. I'm talking about the nature of a country that has been in revolution since 1959. The Americans are their neighbors. They tried to invade them. They tried to kill them. They tried to organize so many coup d'etats, and they failed. Why? If they hadn't have good relations with their people, they would not have survived. And that's why I think, yes, democracy is a very important element here. The more a country is in harmony with its own people, and the more it has a democratic way of governance, the stronger it would be. And it won't be vulnerable to external pressures.
I mean, just while we're on that point, it may be beyond the ambit, and obviously I'm going to talk about Syria now. And obviously the government in Syria is still very new, so it's a bit probably too early to speculate on exactly what they'll stand and what they will do. But Bashar al-Assad wasn't necessarily kind to Palestinians in any way. He killed many Palestinians in Yarmouk. He subjugated many Palestinians in Syria to the same treatment that he subjugated his own people to. But the Assad regime did verbally, from time to time, support Palestinian causes through the years. Do you feel that now the Palestinian people have a much stronger ally in Damascus? Like I said, even though it's a very new government and there's a lot of uncertainty, how do you feel about that?
It all depends on how the regime will deal with the fact that Israel is occupying its land. That's the most important indicator. And now I just heard that the Israeli army has put checkpoints between Dir'a and the road to Damascus, I think. درعا and كنيطرة. I mean, how will they deal with this? I mean, just recently they've made a statement about Israeli occupation of their land. But this is the indicator. If they are going to defend their land and if they want to get rid of the Israeli occupation as we do, we will simply be allies, of course. But I think there is a great need for them to take that position against the Israeli aggression on Syrian land.
Isn't it a bit more? I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it doesn't also require some nuance. I mean, because at the same time, it's a fragile state. It's a fragile government. They could very easily, again, be accused of being extremists and Al-Qaeda and lose legitimacy. They also have a duty to kind of rebuild their country after a very big, devastating war where millions of people were made refugees. So I'm not saying that they should, but I mean, I'm sure just like, you know, in the same way that King Abdullah was shuffling in his chair very uncomfortably, there's their own shuffle that they have to kind of make. You know, I mean, where they need to kind of play a game where they get legitimacy and can lift the sanctions on their country and make international allies so they can rebuild a strong state. And immediately going up against the Israeli checkpoints that are being set up may deter that.
I don't agree with that. I don't think that ends justify means. And I think there are principled positions that have to be taken when it comes to the sovereignty of your country. And I'm not saying I know that Israel destroyed their army completely and destroyed their military forces totally. I'm not asking them to go into war with Israel. But there has to be clear stance against what Israel has done to them. Israel used the momentum to destroy all defense capabilities of Syria. And now Israel is engaging in two processes. One is occupying the land of Syria in a much wider amount of land. And now they are in the process of expanding the annexation. They've already annexed the Golan Heights. There should be at least a position saying that we don't accept the annexation of our land, you know? And second, Israel is playing another game of divide and conquer, playing on the issue of Druze and the issue of Kurds, etc., etc. So Israel in this case is an enemy not only because they are occupying their land, but they are an enemy of their future because they are trying to keep Syria divided and weak.
Dr. Mustafa Harbourousi, final question. You've obviously, this last year, you've probably know many people who have been killed. A lot of Palestinian leaders have been killed. You're a prominent Palestinian leader yourself. Have you feared for your own life? What measures have you taken to kind of ensure that you are kept alive? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I know my life is at risk. That's not surprising. What can I do? I mean, if I will not have a military crowd around me to protect me, I don't think this is the way. I don't feel that I am different from anybody else or that I am better than anybody else. I was almost killed 3 times already. In 96, I was shot twice with live ammunition by an Israeli sniper who saw me that while I was trying to treat an injured person and stop the bleeding. And I was in my white coat. I wasn't doing political work. I was doing medical work. And that sniper shot me. I still carry 34 shrapnels in my back and shoulders. I was lucky. It was just a matter of maybe 1 centimeter. And then, you know, I was attacked several times. I was stabbed once in 2015. What will happen. But the most important thing is that there is a duty that I have to fulfill as a person, as a Palestinian. And if I have capabilities that can serve my people, our people, then I have to use them. And it's God's will at the end of the day. What will happen will happen.
Any final thoughts before we conclude?
My last thought is that I believe that we will succeed. I am full of internal calm that this case is the case of justice of the Palestinian people. As you said, I don't know this. We will be free in 2 years, 10 years, 15 years, 50 years. Maybe not in my lifetime. I don't know. But I know one thing. We will be free. I know one thing. Justice will come. I know one thing, that the Palestinian people will overcome. And it will be a great honor for anybody to be participant in this liberation struggle.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, thank you so much. We know that you have a little time, so thank you for sharing it with us, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
We are out of time, but I want to remind you that it does take a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Mohammed Al-Ghul and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Stan Robinson and Steve Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.
Thank you. Thank you.